Welcome to this week's colloquium. Today we're pleased to have Dean Bruno Mano speaking. He got his PhD from University of Texas, Houston, did a postdoc at UC San Francisco, and is now at UCLA as a professor in the neurobiology and psychology departments, I guess. He also is the author of a popular book called Brain Bugs, How the Brain's Flaws Shape Our Lives. But today, I guess he's going to talk to us about time dynamics chaos in the brain.
Can everybody hear me okay? Thank you, Daniel, and I think I'd like to thank Daniel and Lee for inviting me and everybody for coming. It's been a pleasure to learn a bit more about the physics of time in my meetings this morning. Time, of course, plays a fundamental role in many questions in physics, including why time seems to be a one-way street, despite the fact that the equations we use to describe the laws of nature are time-symmetric, the difference between the past, present, and future, and the very nature of the universe and space-time. To the neuroscientist, time also plays a very fundamental role for entirely different reasons. Chief among them is the fact that ultimately the brain is a prediction machine. The brain's primary task is temporal in nature. Your brain evolved in order to help us and other animals predict, anticipate, and prepare for the short and the long-term future. For that reason, you are currently automatically and unconsciously always predicting what will happen next. And if I pause there, a bunch of little lights go off in your head and say, uh-oh, what's wrong with the speaker? Because there's been a mismatch between your expectation, your prediction, and what's actually happened in the world. So this is continuously going on, you can't avoid it, and it's one of the primary tasks your brain evolved to do. Now you might say, well, didn't the brain evolve, say, for something like memory? Now remember, memory, storing information about the past, is from an evolutionary perspective useless in and of itself. Memories are about the past, but they're future-oriented. The only reason memories evolved was precisely to allow us to better adapt to future situations. So even memory is about time in the sense that it allows us to better predict the future. Now, for this audience, obviously, a question that is relevant is there any intersection between the time that neuroscientists that are concerned with and the time of physics. And there's a lot of seductive or interesting parallels between both. And both in the context of neuroscience, the context of physics, people often say, well, time is an illusion. But when physicists and neuroscientists say that, I think we mean entirely different things. On the physics extreme, you have people that sort of take the view that time essentially doesn't exist in the sense that it's a useful emergent property that allows us to understand the universe better, but not really a physical property of the universe. But what what everybody can agree on is that we can't agree on a definition of time. And I think a lot of people have pointed this out. Lee has done so recently in one of his books, Time Reborn. And there's a quote that's commonly used here from St. Augustine. What then is time? If no one asks me, I know what it is. If I wish to explain it to him, asks, I do not know. So this has been over 1.5 millennia that I don't think we've really made that much progress in defining time. Other people, like the author Douglas Adams, the author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, helpfully offered time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so. But it's the physicist Richard Feynman, the ever-pragmatic Richard Feynman, who said, maybe it's just as well we face the fact that time is one of those things we probably cannot define. What really matters anyways is not how we define time, but how we measure it. This is certainly true for neuroscience. I think a lot of people here would disagree with that statement in the context of physics. But in neuroscience, that's precisely what we're concerned about, is how does the brain measure time? How does the brain create its clocks? And when we're studying time in the brain, The first thing we have to realize is that the brain tells time over at least 12 orders of magnitude, from microseconds to the yearly revolutions of the Earth around the Sun. And on microsecond scale, that's what you use to tell sound localization. So the time it takes sound to arrive from your right to your left ear, it's a couple of hundred milliseconds. And your brain is using that temporal information to make a computation about space. It's quite amazing your brain can do this, given the fact that sort of the minimal time unit, the length of an action potential of a neuron, that's the electrical bioelectrical signal of the neuron, is around 1 millisecond. So then we have time perception, which is sort of, I'll give you a couple of examples of that, which is still sort of unconscious timing. Your brain is using temporal information about sensory cues to interpret the environment around it. And then we have what people normally think about in time perception here. This is time estimation. This is what is your subjective feeling of time. Above that, we have circadian rhythms, our daily cycles that are common to both animals and plants, by the way. And above that, we even have what we call infradian rhythms. These are things like a menstrual cycle, hibernation cycles, and we make long-term planning and so-called intertemporal decisions. This is when you make a decision, well, should I save this $100 for my retirement, or should I go out and buy a new iPhone or something of the sort? So critical to the question of time in the brain is the realization that you don't have one clock. There's no such thing as a master clock in your brain. You have many different mechanisms that underlie timing. Each one of these has a different characteristic. They have different levels of precision and different levels of computational abilities to recognize patterns, their precision, and their reset abilities. So if it's easy to reset that clock or difficult to reset that clock. So the microsecond processing, it's not very good for pattern recognition. These are temporal structures of stimuli, but it can be easily reset, then starting up. The most precise clock, interestingly, in the body is the circadian clock, then the order of 1 or 2% standard deviation or precision of 1 or 2%. It doesn't reset very well. It's very hard to reset. That's why you have jet lag, is when you cross the time zones. It's very hard to reset that clock. And it's also not very good for patterns. Time estimation is your subjective sense of time. It's not particularly precise. It's 10%. It's easy to reset. But again, it's not very good for patterns. And time perception on the order of milliseconds to a few seconds has a precision of around 10 to 20%. It's variable as to how we define if it's easy or hard to reset. But it's very good at patterns, and that's what you're doing right now. And I'm going to give you an example of what I mean by time patterns. You're not just interested in the interval or the duration of an event, but actual the temporal structure of something. And in speech, time is of essence. So if I say a sentence such as, he gave her cat food, or if I say, he gave her cat food, those are two different meanings that you're interpreting there based on the timing. And you're doing this continuously, again, automatic. If you remove the time, speech comprehension goes way down. There's another example in phoneme recognition. So here you'll hear three examples of artificially generated sound in which you have the C or st.
C.
So you can probably hear the difference between those phonemes. But the difference is really purely temporal. There's not spectral information there in the conventional sense. And all the difference is that we just manipulated the pause between the so-called fricative component, that's the s, and the vowel. And your interpretation of that sound interprets. It doesn't sound like there's a delay. You don't have a conscious perception of that time difference. But your brain is detecting that time difference to give you the different interpretation of those sounds. And of course, one of my favorite examples of how good we are at temporal processing in terms of patterns is the fact that we can reduce language to a purely temporal code. and that's temporal code in Morse code. So in Morse code, you're reducing the normal spectral content of language to purely the interval and duration and pauses between the dits and the dats, the dashes and the dots. So, and of course, timing in music is equally important, but also in the motor domain. So this is examples in the sensory domain. In the motor domain, we can train people to just sort of do a piano keyboard-like task in which your people have to press different keys on a keyboard with this spatial-temporal pattern over many trials, and we can look at the standard deviation of their responses over many trials, fit that with a Gaussian, and over days, people get better. Their timing improves with practice. And we can quantify that and see the statistical signatures of the clock, of the brain's clock, or the brain's timing device. And one of the characteristics here is that the variance increases linearly with a function of time, as a function of time squared. These are the first day, second day, so you're getting better and better. But there's a signature here, and this signature is different from what you'd expect from a oscillator with random independent noise in which the variance would increase as a function of t of time, not time squared. I actually don't know, I'm curious, if anybody knows, please tell me how time, how the variance or the precision increases as a function of time in the case, say, of an atomic clock. I don't know the variance signatures. This is a bit different from the question of what's called Allen variation. But if anybody knows the equivalent to this, I'd like to know. So ultimately, the question is how does the brain tell time with a bunch of these things over here? So these are neurons, and you have around 100 billion neurons in your brain, and they're connected to each other by the synapses. Those are the connection strengths in which one neuron influences the other, and you have around 100 trillion of those in your brain. And we'll go in a bit of detail about their properties. But as an initial approach in my presentation, I'm going to describe what we call firing rate models of randomly connected recurrent neural networks. So in these networks, this is based on previous models by a couple of people that I should highlight here, Jaime Sopolinsky from Israel, Herbert Jaeger from Germany, and Larry Abbott and David Cicillo then at Columbia. So in these models, which we call firing rate models of recurrent neural networks, you have a bunch of units which are representing our neurons, and they're randomly connected to each other, and the dynamics of the system is governed by a set of nonlinear differential equations shown here. So this would be, we can think of it as the voltage of each unit, and the voltage has a decay time constant, and the input is determined by the activity of the other units, its neighbors, that are connected to it through this weight matrix, this coefficient matrix of the recurrent connections here. So in physics, this has certain similarities with an Ising spin model or a glass spin model, except there's significant differences. In an Ising spin model, these are symmetric coefficients. Here, they're asymmetric, and the nonlinearities are different. And typically, in those systems, you're interested in the steady state. Here, we'll see we're interested in the dynamics of the system. So the key here is these weights, these coefficients, which determine the interaction between all of those elements. And so in these situations, we're pretending that the neurons can take on a value between minus 1 and 1, and all of them connect to these output to an output unit, and that's a simple linear, weighted linear summation of the activity in the recurrent network. Now, when you simulate these, you observe transition that you typically see in a lot of nonlinear dynamic systems. So if those weights are distributed tightly around zero, and you give an input, the system quickly, the activity in the network quickly fades back to zero, it decays. So here, what I'm showing you in these simulations is each line is one of the units in the recurrent network. And here, the thicker line is just the sum of these, weighted sum of these, and that's the output unit. This is just a subset of the neurons. So in the case in which these weights have a relatively weak or tight standard deviation around zero, they're in this fading regime. In a high gain regime, when these weights are stronger, now you go into this novel regime and the self-perpetuating regime in which the activity just stays on ad infinitum. Now, the characteristic of this is that this is a chaotic regime, and this has been described by many in many different ways. So what that means, as I'm sure everybody knows, if we look now at 100 units, this is the spatial-temporal pattern of activity in the simulation, just color-coded, so this is 100 units, that's the pattern of activity over time, and if we just look at 3 units, and then at time zero, we give a strong input, which brings this to a relatively tight volume of your state space, you're going to see a fairly rapid and exponential divergence of those patterns because there's slightly different initial conditions. We'll also add noise here. Here we don't have noise. So that's a chaotic system. These patterns are diverging. So essentially, by the time you're over here, you have no memory of what happened over here. So the memory of the system is lost. If we ignore that for a moment, I want to just transmit the computational potential of these systems. So if it has a rich pattern, and we're ignoring the fact that it's chaotic for a moment, but if we only always started off in the same way, you can see that you can solve a temporal task, right? If you want this output unit to fire at, or to fire to create a signal at 1.8 seconds, you can just read out the pattern of activity, the point in state space that corresponds to this point in time and the trajectory to determine your desired timed response. So let me just give you a better idea of how that would work in a simulation. So when we simulate a network, what this is showing you is these are the traces. This is with relatively weak coupling coefficients. And there's an input pattern here. There was a little movie of what was happening over here. And the activity goes up, and then it just decays. If we increase the coupling coefficients a bit, then it goes into an intermediary regime, which is also commonly observed in dynamical systems, which is just a limit cycle. And so after a settling point, it will just oscillate over here. Each one of these units will oscillate the same way because it's in a limit cycle. Outside that regime, you then go into this chaotic or high gain regime in which it's basically a strange attractor, a chaotic attractor. The problem is, as I said, is this is chaotic. So if we have a bit of noise in the system, so we can train even though it's chaotic, we can try to just find the set of coefficients here that will allow this output unit to, say, have a memory of what happened over here and read out the time at 1.8 seconds, but if there's any noise in the system, that ability is lost. So it will give you a different response each time because of the divergence. So what we want to know is there a way that the brain can preserve the complexity of the dynamics, but remove the chaos. So obviously, there's a lot of experimental data showing that the brain exhibits chaotic regimes, that very small changes in the voltage of a neuron can change the dynamics of the network. But on the other hand, it's clear that the brain isn't always operating in a chaotic regime because we can get by in the world. We can do the same thing over and over, and we can reliably produce the same spatial-temporal patterns of input and of output. So the question is how might the brain achieve this? So one of the approaches is that if there was some way to tune those recurrent weights, those coefficients of the W matrix. That's been challenging to date and a long-standing problem, and for a number of reasons. The traditional approach to what we call learning or supervised learning in a neural network is to adjust these weights according to some error reduction algorithm, in which you say, okay, you know what you want the output to be, and this is how you change the weights in order to reduce that error until you get the error you decide, the output that you desire. Now that's typically done in what we call a feed-forward network without recurrency. So in that case, it reduces to a number of techniques in statistics, and these are things called the perceptron or backpropagation, and also related to what are called deep belief networks. But when you have a recurrent network, it's not immediately obvious what the target is, what you as the supervisor should tell the network to be doing. In the framework that we're talking about here, that we call the state-dependent network framework or reservoir computing, the key is that it doesn't really matter what the recurrent network does, as long as the pattern is high-dimensional and reproducible. So what we're going to do here is train this network to do something that it was already doing while it was in the chaotic state. So we're going to pick a trajectory and train the network to reproduce that arbitrary trajectory, which we're going to call the innate trajectory. So we're going to adjust the coefficients in order for that network to learn one of the trajectories that it happens to be, that we happen to choose. So there's a couple of ways to do this, but basically you need a learning rule in which you change these coefficients. So you have a delta W here, in which the W is adjusted according to the error for each unit. So for each unit I here, you adjust it according to the error, meaning what you determined it should be as part of the innate pattern and what it actually was based on the presynaptic input, that means the element that's feeding into it, times some adaptive scaling factor, which in this case happens to be related to the inverse correlation matrix of all the inputs to that unit. So this is called the RLS, the recursively square learning rule. So the basic idea is we're just going to train each of the units to reproduce a pattern that it was already doing, the innate pattern. So here's the network again here, and here's the pre-training. And after training, it is no longer in a chaotic regime. So here's the input. Starts off with slight deviations, but it stays on track during the window over which you trained it. So you picked a segment around 2 seconds long, and then you trained it over that 2 seconds long, and within that 2 seconds long segment, it creates a reproducible trajectory. So the output unit now, you have an overlap between both trials in the red and the green. So we can see that here in state space. So we can, this is, I think those are 1,000 units, and we can reduce that using principal component analysis. And so you're just plotting the trajectories before training and after training in the three principal component space. And so here is time in color, and you have an input on one trial, an input on a separate second trial. That brings it to the same region of state space, but if it was possible to follow that, you'd see that they're diverging and you're sort of losing the memory of the input. After training, you have the input here, but it stays on track. These are overlapping, so you can show that these parts of the trajectories, or these segments of the trajectory, are locally stable, and thus they can encode time. You can also show this by calculating the Lyapunov, the maximal Lyapunov exponent, before training and after training in response to the input that you gave. So you can see that this now goes to, on average, very close to zero. But the system is still chaotic. So it's not that the network is no longer chaotic. Outside, in response to a different point, to a different input, or outside the trained area, the network still behaves in a chaotic fashion. So it has a chaotic regime, and it has a locally stable regime over some segment. So it's sort of the way we're currently looking at it, as it has a locally stable trajectory embedded within a chaotic attractor. So from a neuroscience perspective, this is potentially a very useful regime in that it allows the brain to encode information, which can be a behavioral task or a temporal task or just simply keeping track of time. So now this is in the presence of significant amounts of noise, in which you inject a lot of ongoing noise into the network over two trials, one shown in red and one shown in blue. You give the input, and despite the fact that each unit of these networks are varying significantly in their exact values, the general trajectory is close enough to read out the time in a fairly reliable manner. We can also capture the statistical signature of the clock that I showed you in the motor task. So as I mentioned, the variance in our motor tasks tends to increase linearly with time squared. And if you look at the across trials now, the timing at different points in time over multiple trials, that is also increasing approximately linearly with time squared. So that's called Weber's law. And that's a fairly general characteristic, but not universal characteristic, of biological timing. So having these networks now gives us an ability to do more realistic, biologically realistic computations. So here's an example how you can use the stable transient dynamics to generate motor patterns. So now you have the dynamics in this system that has some stable segments, and now we're connecting these to two output neurons, X and Y, which we will simply call X and Y, and that will mark the position of a pointer or a pin on a surface, and we've trained these units to outline, to write, do handwriting, to write a word. So in this case, you're encoding time, shown here, but you're also encoding the spatial-temporal pattern necessary to create this pattern. So the network's ongoing activity, and I'll show you a simulation of that. You give an input, and it will trace this output. You can do for more than one or two words, so it has a certain capacity to do encode different number of patterns over different numbers of over different time periods. Now, the interesting part of this is that it has a memory. So the novel part here is that once you have a trajectory, the system somehow has a memory of where it wants to be. So once you engage the trajectory and you perturb it, you kick it off, you bump it off its current path, you're disturbing it, it will slowly converge back to that and complete the word. So now you have a memory that's related to the dynamics of the system. So typically in neuroscience, the view was that memory or information is stored in a steady state. So you have this network of neurons, and that when you have a input, the system converges to a representation, a piece of information, somebody's name, an image, a concept, and the memory is stored in that steady state. So here, the notion is that the memory is in the trajectory itself. So let me just show you a quick simulation of that. So in the baseline state, you have 10 units of something like 1,000 units in this recurrent network, and they're just going across with some spatial-temporal pattern of activity. And that's driving this 1,000-dimensional system to this 2-dimensional system, which is just writing out these random-looking patterns here. But the network has already been trained to tune these weights to follow specific trajectories in response to input 1, in response to input 2, and as have these weights been trained to generate those two handwritten patterns that you saw before, neuron or chaos. So if I press, if we give it the input 1, it will go to a point in state space, and the trajectory it follows will spell out chaos or neuron. And then the important characteristic here regarding the memory is, even in the presence of noise, I'm just going to slow that down, is if we give it the input, then perturb it, so we knocked it off of there, it returns. So you have a return to the trajectory that it learned. Okay, so I'm going to shift back here. Are there any questions? And please feel free to interrupt if you'd like any clarifications. Okay. Now, so this is a demonstration of how the brain might encode time using dynamics. So that's an idea that's been around for maybe 15 years or so. But the challenge was to overcome the fact that most of these systems in the regimes that they can encode time are also chaotic. So this is a step showing that, at least in some cases, it is possible to remove the chaos of the system while keeping the complexity of the system. But the fact is that real neural networks are much more complicated. And these, we made some very glaring simplifications in those models. So real neurons are multi-compartmental units. They have the cell soma, dendrites, and axons, and they connect to each other at different points in their, what we call their dendritic arbor, for example. So this red neuron might have an axon that comes around and synapses on the gray neuron somewhere around here. So this is a recording of two neurons simultaneously. So this is the voltage. And as one neuron fires, you depolarize it, you're increasing the voltage, it will reach a threshold and then induce the spikes, the action potentials. Each spike is the signal to transmit a bit of information, I don't mean that literally, a pulse of information to the postsynaptic neurons in the form of these EPSPs. So those are the excitatory postsynaptic potentials, so all the communications, or the great majority of the communication between the neurons, is mediated by these voltage deflections where this neuron releases a transmitter and that causes a small depolarization in the postsynaptic neuron. Similarly, this neuron is connected to this neuron, so these two neurons are reciprocally connected. But what I want to highlight here is the fact that in reality, these weights, these strengths here, are highly variable. So in the equations, we were looking at the W's as constants over a short time scale. But in fact, they're varying. So most physical systems that I'm familiar with don't have this added complication in which the coupling coefficients themselves are functions of time on the time scale, on very short time scale. So this adds a further complexity. And we call that short-term synaptic plasticity. And one of the evolving models is that the brain is processing information by the interaction of its internal state with the incoming information from the external world. So information is encoded by the internal state of the system interacting with the external state of the system, and that naturally encodes temporal information. So in the same way that the raindrops falling on a pond naturally has temporal information in it, you can immediately tell me which raindrop fell first and which raindrop fell second because of the internal dynamics of the system. So these state-dependent network models in the context of neuroscience, and sometimes it's called, also called liquid state machines in the machine learning field, propose that in the sensory domain, temporal computations arise from the interaction between the internal state of the networks and incoming stimuli. The state of the network is defined not only by its active state, which neurons are firing, but its hidden state. And that's what the short-term synaptic plasticity was, and I'll give you an example of that in a minute. Now, the inherent complexity of neural networks, the inherent complexity of the circuits that we have in our cortex contribute to the information processing, not because they're carefully tuned to process any specific piece of information, but because they ensure that virtually any stimulus that you present to the cortex, it will be represented in very high dimensional space, which makes it easy to decode. So here an analogy with the immune system is helpful. So the immune system takes the seemingly crazy approach of making billions and billions of antibodies, more or less at random, in order to cover the necessary parameter space of all possible antigens, of all possible germs. So it's a very brute force approach. And here the idea is that the cortex, in part, also uses a brute force approach in that it uses the massive number of neurons in the brain to ensure that you have a very high dimensional representation of virtually any complex stimuli. Now, what I mean by active and hidden states is the following. The active state is if you record from, say, 100 neurons, and you look at that simultaneously, just like we were looking in our simulations, you can have the state defined in 110-dimensional space, and this would be the neural trajectory of that in 110-dimensional space. So that's the active state, that's the sort of standard view of the state of a neural network. So those are the spikes. So this would be, each one of these would be a neuron, and we put the dots where it had an action potential, where it had a spike, where it had its nonlinearity. It is possible. Now, so in this case, you're being faked out a bit because these recordings were not done simultaneously, and they were just done over multiple trials. But now it is possible to record simultaneously, extracellularly, from hundreds of neurons. But it's still challenging. So that would allow you to create these sort of high-dimensional representations of neurons. Of neural network dynamics. So the hidden states are what I was referring to, the short-term synaptic plasticity. So remember, these are the W's are varying in time. So the weight of a synapse between two connections, so that's the depolarization produced by an action potential in one neuron to the other, changes in time. It can get stronger or a bit weaker depending on if it has short-term facilitation or depression. But the key here is just that the W's of those matrices themselves are varying in time. And while that makes the analysis very complicated, it allows for potentially useful temporal filtering abilities that allow neurons to discriminate temporal intervals. So these are just another example. So here you have depression between two excitatory neurons or facilitation. Here you have an inhibitory neuron, meaning that the inhibitory neurons cause a hyperpolarization. They decrease the voltage of the excitatory neurons. And the weight of that connection can decrease. So that's what we call short-term depression of the inhibition. So as I said, that allows for interesting temporal filtering properties. And it turns out that you can use those properties to create neurons that are interval selective. So if you have a simple simulation, and now we have a simple simulation based on slightly more realistic neurons because they have spikes, but we only have two neurons, And if you have the right balances of short-term facilitation and depression, where the weights are changing, you can create neurons that are selective to a 50 millisecond interval. So here's your excitatory neuron, and here you have paired pulses. So it's like beep, 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 or beep, beep. And you want to discriminate the short interval from the long interval. So this is something you would do in music, and we can train people in the lab in which you're doing a discrimination, an interval discrimination. Yeah, you have a question? Yeah. So I don't know if I quite heard you, but I think you're asking the parameter question, which is we're getting the parameters we know from the experimental data and then incorporating them into the models. But we're tuning the weights a bit. So there's certainly tuning going on here, okay? But they're based on the range we see in the experimental data of the time characteristics of the increases and decreases in the synaptic weights. So sorry, this is being cut off on the lower one, but this is the inhibitory neuron. I don't know if that's coming up here. So then if we change these weights, the synaptic strengths, then you can create a neuron that now responds to 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds. So here, because of the balance of the excitation inhibition in the inhibitory neuron, this now the inhibitory neuron is firing at these early intervals. And that's cutting off, preventing the supra threshold response in the excitatory neuron. So this is just a game of balancing excitation inhibition that you can play if your system has short-term synaptic plasticity. And it seems that in some systems, neurons tell time exactly in this fashion. So this is an example from experimental data by the group of Bruce Carlson, in which he's recording from neurons in the brainstem of electric fish. So electric fish use electrical pulses, use the timing of electrical pulses to communicate with each other. And in this neuron here, this is a recording over three trials, voltage on the y-axis, and these are the electrical pulses presented at 100 millisecond intervals, 50 millisecond intervals, or 10 millisecond intervals. And you can see that this neuron fires, it has its action potentials in response to the 50 millisecond intervals, but not the 10 or the 100. And the data indicates that this is due to the short-term synaptic plasticity of these synapses, the fact that the weights vary in a use-dependent fashion. The weights themselves vary as a function of time. Now, the models, however, the state-dependent networks, the liquid state machine models, however, is not that timing is achieved by tuning these single synapses, but rather, as I alluded to before, it's a property of the entire network. So because of the fact that all the neurons in your cortex have these properties, some percentage of them will respond to this temporal pattern or that temporal pattern. So here's the result of that, is that the system, the trajectories of the system, are temporally asymmetric. So when I mean temporally asymmetric, that's a bit different than would be commonly used in physics. Here we're just referring to the fact that in response to this inverting the input to the system, the network's response is temporally asymmetric. So here in a simulation, let's say we're looking at the spoken digit 1. So this is a spectrogram of somebody saying 1. And this is the spatiotemporal pattern of action potentials that might be observed in your cochlea, on your auditory nerve. So it would decompose this into this pattern, binary pattern of spikes. And this part here would be symmetric. If we reverse this, we might get a very similar spatiotemporal pattern of these at the level of the auditory nerve. And that's what we're showing here in the simulation. And this is shown here now again in principal component space of the first three principal components. And time is in color with blue 0. And when we do it in the forward order, it follows this trajectory. When you do it in the reverse order, it's just temporally symmetric. It just follows the reverse trajectory. But because of the properties of the cortical network, now when you put this into the recurrent network, in which you have short-term synaptic plasticity and internal dynamics, then you lose the temporal symmetry. So now, if you look at the pattern produced here in principal component space, produces this pattern, and when you do the invert, it's an entirely different pattern. So the patterns being formed at the level of the cortex are temporally asymmetric because of the interaction between the stimuli and the internal state of the system. And this is, of course, what's observed experimentally. So when people record from the brains of rodents or another animal model is the zebra finch. It's a type of singing bird. And it's a good model for speech because their vocalization. They learn how to vocalize, they learn how to sing, and it's a form of communication that has significant similarities with speech. So if you're recording from a neuron, so here you're just showing the spikes of the neuron again over multiple trials, and you present the forward song shown here in the sonogram, this neuron fires vigorously to the forward song. You reverse the song, so it's the same spectral content, and this neuron doesn't fire at all. So there's abundant data, there's abundant experimental data showing that the temporal sensitivity, the temporal direction selectivity, the temporal asymmetry of neural responses in response to incoming inputs. And this seems to be as a result that we describe in these state-dependent network models of the state dependency of the interactions together with things like short-term synaptic plasticity. So let me conclude by quickly summarizing and saying that when it comes to time, the brain clearly has many different clocks. Each is specialized for different temporal scales and functional needs, depending on the precision, whether you need patterns, whether you need to rapidly reset or not. Second, experimental and theoretical evidence, and I didn't go over much of the experimental evidence, indicate that the brain uses neural dynamics of recurrent networks to tell time on the time scale of milliseconds and seconds. To date, however, these networks have traditionally been limited to how well we can capture their potential computational power because of chaos. We now know that, at least under some circumstances, we can tame the chaos by appropriately tuning the coupling coefficients, the weights of the recurrent network. And lastly, some of this work has contributed to a shift in how we think about how the brain works, how the brain performs computations. So one of the dominant views has been, as I mentioned earlier, that computations arise from neural networks converging to a steady state that might represent a memory. And this was a very influential idea, in part supported by theoretical work by Hopfield and what are called Hopfield networks. But the emerging view, I think it's becoming more clear that much of what the brain does and how it computes is based on these stable trajectories, on these dynamics of the network dynamics. And in a sense, then, computations arise from the voyage through state space as opposed to the destination in state space. So lastly, I'm just going to thank a couple of the members of the lab. Rodrigo Laggi was critical in doing some of the simulations that I showed you today. So thank you very much.
So we like to give students the first chance for questions. So are there any students who have questions?
Just quickly, how long roughly? You said for the writing simulation, about 1,000 nodes, did you say, roughly?
Units?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long does it take to train those?
Maybe 20 or 30 training trials, so not very many compared to a feed-forward network, which is fortunate because the computation is much more intense because it's a recurrent network and the calculations are significantly more involved. So each trial is significantly more computationally intensive, but you need much fewer training trials. But the time, of course, it's realistic time to do on a laptop. It's doable on a laptop.
Again, with the reservoir computing handwriting stuff, have you tried to do that with spiking neurons at all?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We are trying, other people are trying. We don't quite know how to do it yet, though. So there's a lot of simplifications that the firing rate neurons allow you to do this in a more tractable fashion. So the fact is yes, that's an intense area of research, but we don't quite know how to do it yet. Clearly, we believe the brain does it, but we have a couple of things to figure out still.
Are there any other student questions? Okay, let's throw it open to questions from everybody.
Thanks. Please say more about what it means to have computation done through a voyage through state space.
So when I say computation, I'm thinking of either it could be a decision in terms of you're giving a sensory pattern that's varying in time. And if you have to make a decision whether that was the word neuron or chaos, you're listening to those, it will take different trajectories. So if you do a computation based on that, you have output network that can read those points in space and use that trajectory to make the decision that the task that you're trying to solve. Another example would be in the handwriting, the task, the computation, is creating the pattern in response to an input. So the information is encoded in the trajectory as opposed to the steady state in this case, which is not particularly relevant. And there's data in some systems, in the case of olfaction, that the odor is encoded not by the steady state, but by the trajectory. And the same odor takes similar trajectories, but the concentration sort of expands those trajectories. So you want to not only encode the odor, but the concentration, and so forth.
But how do the output neurons that have to report the decision, whether it's chaos or neuron, represent the trajectory, or how do they track the trajectory?
So that's something that neurons actually are very well suited to do, right? Because the trajectory is just a vector in however many neurons you have in your state space. And then these output neurons can take the weighted sum of that vector. You have to tune the weights there. But because it's very high dimensional, it turns out to be very easy to do mathematically or with supervised learning rules to read out points in state space that are part of this trajectory or this trajectory to make this neuron respond to one but not the other. So just vector summation makes neurons are very well suited for that task, actually.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your talk is very understated, but the last conclusion is revolutionary, isn't it? Can I just highlight that? I mean, we physicists are fond of, well, I don't know, we hear a lot of statements of the sort of, well, the brain is just another kind of computer, the brain is just another kind of Turing machine. But the output of a computer or Turing machine is to write something onto memory or onto a tape. And the implication of your conclusion is that the brain doesn't write anything on a memory or on a tape. It decides things dynamically, and there is no record of...
Yeah, it's certainly a different type of record. So there's the debate about how to view the brain as a Turing machine is a complex one, as I'm sure you know. But certainly, in terms of the part of the Turing machine in which you're writing bits of information down on your tape, I don't see that capturing the dynamics very well. I mean, yes, there's always some way to do it, but in the sense that here the notion is that the computation, the decision, is not something that's easily pinpointed because it's in the evolution of the system. I think that hints at a divergence between a sort of a conventional Turing, universal Turing machine type approach. And even within neuroscience, I think there's this transition that I like to think the field is embracing. We'll see if that's true. That the computations themselves are dynamic, so there's nothing being written down, or it's hard to point where the decision was made. So it makes it a bit harder to study, but I think it's a more, I think it captures time much better. I think the brain evolved, as I started saying out earlier, as a prediction machine. The brain's task is inherently temporal, and I think the solutions, it's not surprising to me, are inherently temporal, so inherently dynamic in this case.
Yeah, so the reason why you said those things at the beginning becomes clear. If the brain is not primarily, if the brain's purpose is not primarily to make memories, is it possible that forming memories is a late adaptation and there are early systems, primitive biological systems with neurons or ganglia which make computations but don't form memories?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think in the simplest systems where you have very simple organisms, here I'm talking about maybe famous mollusks that neuroscience studied, the ones called the aplysia. And these things, they have very simple circuits. And they're very feed-forward, there's some recurrency. So clearly in those cases, I think the memory is sort of the standard memory, that you learn that you want to go left or right in response to stimuli, so you just change the strength of this synapse. But now, with the later evolutionary emergence of complex recurrent circuits that characterize the cortex of mammals and humans, there I think that the memories are much more fuzzy here, in terms of they're not the conventional thinking of flipping a bit or strengthening a synapse, but changing the system as a whole to control or to create the appropriate trajectories. And it's hard if you ask me to point out where the memory is in to store chaos or neuron or to do one of those decisions. You know, it's an emergent property. So it doesn't, the question barely makes sense. So I think, yes, I think it does shift the way we're thinking about what a memory is.
But can you not think of the list of weights as some way encoding the same thing? If you wanted to think of it as a Turing machine, you give me some list of W's for all the neurons, and that in some nonlinear way encodes all the memories. It's still just a list of numbers.
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, I think that would be the way to do it. I don't think it would be incredibly inefficient or poor way to do it, right? Because you don't have the dynamics of the system. But ultimately, of course, we're simulating this on a Turing machine, right? So obviously, it's doable, but I don't think it naturally captures the way the brain is performing these computations. But of course, you're right. At some sense, there's an equivalence there because that's how we're simulating it.
So you mentioned at the beginning of your talk that the brain manages to estimate time on all these different timescales. I was hoping maybe you could comment a bit on what tricks it uses to estimate time at these other length scales besides the one you spoke about. Yeah. And then I was also wondering just, you're talking about the human brain. How much, what else in the animal kingdom is there in terms of estimating time? Are there other sort of notable examples? And, what diversity of neural networks do we have to experimentally study? Are there some that have, plasticity of the connections and others that don't? Or is there really just one sort of neural network out there?
Okay, so I'll start with the second question. So certainly there's a repertoire of different neural networks, and you can see that within the brain. You have part of your brain, it's called the cerebellum, and that seems to be involved in some sort of sensory motor integration. And the circuitry there is very, very different than in your cortex. So the brain clearly has multiple approaches. We shouldn't look for a magic single code or single type of computation. Similarly, for very simple reflexes, that's a very feed-forward and more hardwired system. So yes, absolutely, and I should be very careful. I don't want to give anybody the impression that this is a universal model of brain function. So in your second, your first question, yes. So on the microsecond scale, let me just jump from the microsecond, the very fast scale, to the circadian scale. The timing mechanisms are fairly well understood, much more so than the scale I'm talking about. So sound localization for right to left, turns out the brain is largely using delay lines. So you have transmission delays, the velocity it takes the bioelectrical signal to travel down the axons, and the brain can tap into those delays on the orders of tens of microseconds. On the circadian scale, on 24-hour cycles, your sleep-wake cycle, it turns out, first place, you don't need a brain to tell. Plants have circadian cycles. So that's very biochemical. That's what we call these transcription-translation autoregulatory feedback loops. So here, you're synthesizing, you're transcribing a piece of DNA into RNA, which makes the proteins, and that can take hours, and it turns off the transcription process itself. So these are very complicated, very well regulated in terms of temperature, because it's hard to do that, to have it always have the same 24-hour cycle at almost any temperature in the case of some animals. So it's an entirely different mechanism. It ends up forming an oscillator. So you have these very nice oscillating biochemical systems. But the timing is not counting those oscillators. So one of the big differences in man-made clocks, right, is we have this almost, the clocks are very complicated, but the concept is almost embarrassingly trivial, right? It's just counting the ticks. And in the biological systems, neurons don't seem to be good counters. So that's something neurons don't do well as computational devices. So transistors are great switches, they're great counters. Neurons are great integrators of simultaneity and coming information, but they don't seem to be designed in any way to do switch-like activity or to count. So while they oscillate, they don't seem to be counting the ticks of those oscillators. So in that sense is what I mean. It's fundamentally different from man-made clocks.
We were talking about timescales. What strikes me in your model is that it has two timescales that are important. The one of the dynamical process in this large dimensional state space, and the timescale of evolution of the weights themselves. Yeah. You mentioned the Hopfield model, which is inspired from spin glass physics, where you have a disordered system, which we define as one that has two timescales, the one of the spins themselves, and the one of the relaxation of the disorder, which is much slower. So I was wondering whether you could comment on the importance of scale separation in computation and learning.
Yeah, and in reality, by the way, we almost have three scales, because you have the time constant of the elements, which I showed you here, they have their own decay time, the passive decay time, which is on the order of 10 to 20 milliseconds. That's the, in an RC circuit, that's the time constant of the circuit. So that's one time scale of tens of milliseconds. Then you have the time scale of the dynamics of a few seconds. Then you have the time scale that you're referring to of the change of the weights. So that's what we would call the learning time scale. So that's indeed a much longer time scale. And we don't know how the brain would be doing that on this. So you have this crossover of these different time scales, and they all interact with each other. So if we change the time constants of the cellular mechanisms, then we prolong the dynamics. So that's one possibility that people have suggested, that you have longer time constants in the system, and that allows you to go tens of seconds or minutes. But it's not clear if that's the case. Now, the time constant of the time scale of the change in these weights, that could be huge. That could be a few hours, or it could be years, in the sense that when you're developing as a child and you're learning to move, you're learning to walk, you're learning to understand speech and talk, there's a lot of learning we take for granted there. There's a lot of changing of those weights, and presumably that's what childhood is about, is finding the correct, tuning those weights in some very complex manner. So it's a very, I think we often forget, as both neuroscientists and scientists, of presumably how complicated that is, and that's why it happens over such a long time scale. But in other cases, maybe you can learn something quick and it can take minutes or hours. So it's a wide range. And there's probably multiple processes there.
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank Dr. Buonomano again.
Thank you.